for this introduction. Hope you will be up to it in today's lecture. And I'm really happy to see so many young faces, and our hope for our subject, probably, that's you. I think it is. At least it was given me already turned on.
Yeah, it's on. Okay, so you might.
So maybe I should approach.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't have a strong voice, unfortunately.
Well, that's what the microphone is good for.
Yeah, okay. Then I decided, and I think it's sort of a tradition during such lectures here, I decided to give a short, not CV, but my scientific, short scientific biography, not because I want you to know a lot about me, but just to try to put these two subjects, the matrix models and the gauge theories, into some historical perspective. And sometimes this historic view is very useful for understanding the circle of ideas, which actually has been developing during maybe the last 40 years already. Horrible to say to me that I was a witness of last 40 years of development, maybe not 40, 35 years of this, of those ideas. So just very briefly about me, I graduated from Gorky University in the mid-70s. Now Gorky is Nizhny Novgorod, quite a big provincial city, 400 kilometers from Moscow. And and I got a diploma, undergraduate diploma, on a very different subject from what I am doing now. It was about something about quantum non-equilibrium thermodynamics. This place, although the university was provincial, it was a very good place, nevertheless. Very good school of radiophysics, quantum optics, nonlinear oscillations, etc., with a very high theoretical culture. So it was useful for me. Although the quantum field theory, which is my later passion, was not very much represented. But then we had guest scientists, like I am now here. And once Alexander Migdal, professor from quite well-known theoretical physicist from Landau Institute of Theoretical Physics from Moscow, came to give a lecture. I met him. He proposed me to pass a so-called Landau theoretical minimum, a cycle of maybe 10, 12 exams, mostly in physics, but also a little bit in applied in mathematics. Which is sort of your pass to theoretical physics, as it was thought of by Landau, the great Soviet scientist, Nobel Prize for superfluidity, for the phenomenon of superfluidity in liquid helium. So it was thought as a pass for anybody. You are a worker on a factory and you pass all 12 exams, you are welcome to start your career in theoretical physics, which I find a very good and democratic idea, of course. And then I probably passed half of those exams and I was told it's okay. I'm qualified for PhD, to start my PhD there at Landau Institute. Under the guidance of Alexander Migdal. And then I was really, I found myself in a fantastic scientific atmosphere of that time in Moscow. I speak about second half of 70s, most of 80s. It was really something which I, in terms of both quality and quantity, it was probably the best place I ever saw in my life. And maybe now it's not like that already, unfortunately, but it was the place to learn the newest, the best ideas in theoretical physics, and also to learn mathematics in a very, in a very creative way, in the way that you really can apply it to physics. Only the list of institutions would really is really astonishing. Like the institutes which had the labs of theoretical physics in Moscow, that's Institute of Theoretical Experimental Physics, Lebedev Physical Institute, Dubna Physical Institute, Serpuhov Institute, Protvino Institute, Institute of Physical Programs, of Solid State, of Korchatov. I mean, I can continue. The list, everywhere there was a lab of theoretical physics. Maybe it was a consequence of this interest to the nuclear project in the past, in the 50s. But anyway, it was really fantastic. And also in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, there were a few very good labs. Great mathematicians worked at the time there, which were always you can always approach them, could always approach them. There were permanently some seminars where you could go and meet them, like Gelfand, Sinai, Novikov, all the great names of mathematics of the second half of last century. Then, now about the circle of ideas. I would say when I came to physics, it was, at least in Moscow, it was still to a great extent solid state physics and statistical mechanics in theoretical physics, which was reigning, especially the theory of phase transitions was largely studied. It was just about people got real interest in quantum field theory. I should say they missed a little bit the oncom of gauge theories, which was very important. Say QCD, people started being interested only in a few years after it was the asymptotic freedom and strong interactions in QCD was discovered. But then they were really serious about it. The same maybe about strings. The beginning was missed, but then quickly people like Polyakov really advanced the subject very much, and Polyakov's approach now is one of the most common in the string theory. Then there was an important breakthrough in so-called integrability in solving two-dimensional field theories, quantum field theories, and also statistical mechanical models, exactly by means of so-called integrability, quantum integrability, classical integrability. That's a subject which we use all the time now, and I think it's something still very, very modern, and it's a great generator of fantastic results, integrability. So remember this word. It's a subject. It's a mathematical and physical subject. Then at some point, I should also say that when people started being interested in quantum field theory, also the subject was becoming more and more, theoretical physics was becoming more and more mathematical. Topology, algebraic geometry, that all people started learning little by little and applying, especially with this fantastic mathematical environment in Moscow. And there was also another subject which probably appeared, another idea which came from Europe at that time, penetrated through the Iron Curtain as a red preprint of Saclay. This was a paper about matrix models. So we got a paper, we got a preprint which has become a bestseller of Brezan et Exon, Parisi and Zuber article, 70 78 or 79, where they studied very simple object, a matrix integral, which I will try to write the simplest possible version. You integrate over a matrix M, the measure of integration. So it's a Hermitian matrix. M dagger is equal to M. So Mij, it's Mij, a matrix, where I and J run from 1 to N. So remember this letter N. It will appear many times in today's talk. So you have N squared degrees of freedom. Essentially, this is a product of all all eigenvalues, all matrix elements. And the measure is also very simple. The weight is also very simple. It's just a trace of some matrix polynomial, namely polynomial of M. Suppose in the simplest case, I can just take M squared minus lambda M cubed, for example. Or M4, if you want it to be converging, so something like that. So it's just, if it was just a number, you would say so what. But if you have a matrix, then you have a certain symmetry. Yes, the Hermitian matrices can be rotated by. Do you know the group theories? I can operate with some group theoretical issues like. Is this symmetry issues? No? It was not yet. Huh?
FO probably, yeah. SU, I know.
Okay. So it was a symmetry SU.
They know SU2.
Okay. Then you can generalize.
Yeah.
Okay. So here you have a certain symmetry because you can rotate this matrix and nothing changes under the integral, neither measure nor the action. You call it the action. What is an exponent? Like in functional. And what about functional integral in quantum mechanics? Feynman integral? Not yet. So some people know something. Yes.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah.
Can you give me some explanation of what's the motivation to propose such a theory?
That's what is the lecture about.
Okay.
So hold on. It's just in a couple of minutes. So, and especially interesting limit was n equals to infinity. With some details, you should put n here, and you should study rather log of z, would have a nice interpretation. So, then I will explain that this limit is related to nice combinatorial problems and is now used all over the place in quantum field theory, where the integrals, functional integrals, look more complicated. But the essential feature of this limit is the same. Then just to finish with the history, there was also an important breakthrough in quantizing two-dimensional quantum field theories, which describe particles in 1+1 dimension. Just one space, one time, where one can calculate, appear to be possible to calculate with very few assumptions, exact non-trivial physical quantities, such as S matrix of scattering of two particles, and it was also a great progress. So, everybody, I remember at the time, wanted to solve something exactly. It was sort of it was all your pass to really to high level theoretical physics and to the recognition. I desperately thought what I should solve to be at least noticed by the people, and I found a nice, almost trivial but not completely trivial model. It's the so-called two-dimensional Young-Mills theory. You will learn a lot during this year about Young Man's theories, but in two-dimensional, it's almost trivial. It's Gaussian. I saw Gaussian integrals. It's sort of Gaussian. But when you study the physical quantities, the average of physical operators, then it becomes a meaningful, little meaningful problem with a nice set of equations to write and to solve. And essentially, this large n limit works very well there. Okay, then I thought, how would I find a path in all this huge sea of ideas? How I would find my way to understand it, to unify my knowledge? And then I started thinking about my little unification, of course, to grand unification, which was also discussed there. And I thought how one can unify the following strange mathematical and physical phenomena. First of all, so on the one hand, there was this integral. I will later say why it is interesting from the combinatorial point of view. Then there were also planar field theories, quantum field theories. Let me use this notation, which is very common now. Planar, this always means that you have fields, quantum fields, which are given as matrices. For example, you can have Aij, like you have here M, which is the vector potential. Potential of Young-Mills theory, like it's just a generalization of electrodynamical vector potential. The only difference is that there it's just a complex function of four-dimensional coordinates. But here, this is a matrix. That's why it's called non-abelian gauge theories. Non-abelian means non-computing. The fields don't compute in different points, for example. They are just different matrices. There could be other fields also, scalars, quarks, etc. And again, I and J go from 1 to n. In QCD, for example, n should be equal to 3, as we know. It's just three colors of quarks. But as an approximation, once great Dutch physicist Gerard Hooft proposed to send n to infinity. Why not? Here it was just a toy model, but why not there? Then, of course, every field theory is characterized by by its interactions. The fields there are interacting and self-interacting. That means that the field describes sort of a virtual particle which propagates in four-dimensional space. Like I'm trying to describe it like x0, which is time, x1, x2, x3. One dimension is here very, I mean, it's orthogonal to our three-dimensional space. And then we study the propagations of particles. For example, you can imagine, I should probably draw a bigger picture. You can imagine in this direction x1, you can put two quarks. Wait, I would put time here and it's just x2, x1 here. So you can imagine putting a quark here and anti-quark, q and q bar. In time, propagate, if they're heavy, They don't move in space, and they propagate only in time. You trace here their wall lines, just straight lines. Now they start exchanging particles, virtual particles. For example, corresponding to this field A, they are called gluons in this case for the Young-Mills or Young-Mills theory. Then you can trace, for example, one gluon can start going out of this line, and I draw it by double line. Why? Because I want to attach to each index a certain notation. Say this is the index A, this is the index J, which propagates. Then this quark, for example, can split in two. Oh, a quark, sorry, gluons can split in two. Again, the index continues to propagate. Of course, this point, according to the laws of quantum mechanics, this point should be integrated out because they can propagate in all possible directions. And this interaction vertex, as we say, can happen anywhere in four-dimensional space. Then it can further propagate, for example, until the next quark. Here can also go there. Then there could be virtual quarks going here. Then could be another quark going there. So you see there are some loops, which correspond to some loops in the sense that there is a virtual particle. You can imagine that it's quark going around. And also loops in terms of indices. Double lines mean that there is an index here, a closed loop of index. And according to the laws of quantum mechanics, you have really to sum up with respect to if the loop is closed, you have just to sum up and you get a factor of n here because each index runs up to n. Then if you have another loop, like here, for example, it's also a loop because quark also carries one index, color index. This is his single index. He's in fundamental. Okay, I don't apply the terminology. Then you have loops somewhere there if it continues. And essentially, each loop is weighted with the index n, with the factor n. If you compute some, for example, the interaction potential between two quarks, or you compute other physical quantities in each loop, of each gluon loop, you will get n. Then, of course, there could be a more complicated loop. For example, the loop can go. Let me draw another gluon propagating. Then, for example, suddenly you can have a loop which the propagating gluon which crosses this line and goes there. So you get sort of multidimensional picture. You have all these double lines going over, up, crossing, not crossing each other, but there seems to be no order in this picture. Nevertheless, if we imagine the full graph of some process, suppose you already have drawn some process, you calculated all these powers of n, for example, you see the loops are more complicated here. You have to follow the loop this way, then you have to go here, etc., and come back. This will be one loop. Already things start being more complicated. But then suppose you have a graph, just closed graph. Then we know something about graphs. We know there exists a famous Euler theorem, which says that the number which says that the number of vertices of the graph, like these are vertices, then minus the number of faces or the number of edges, like each line here is an edge, plus the number of faces is equal to 2 minus 2 genus. You know what is genus in two dimensions? Like a sphere has genus 1, genus 0, then a torus. It's essentially a sphere where you add a handle. Has genus 1, then the double torus, two handles. Has genus 2, etc. So essentially, the genus of a graph is a surface of minimal genus where you can draw your graph without self-intersections. For example, here, if you draw some double lines in one period of the torus, not in other period of the torus, you would never draw them on a surface, on a sphere. For us, the plane is the sphere, more or less. You will never draw it without self-intersections. But there is on the torus, some of them, say, you could imagine that this crossing could, due to the special topology, could be decoupled, could be made without self-intersections. So that's the definition of the graphs and Euler's theorem. Says precisely that. Then we suddenly understand that since n goes to infinity, we favor a lot the faces in this graph. So the number of faces, n, is going to infinity. And actually, for example, if you have only cubic, only triple vertices, then the number of vertices and edges is immediately related to each other. You can easily see that it's like from each vertex you have only three edges outgoing, then each edge belongs to two vertices, so it's like three halves in the proportion here. And then you see that when n goes to infinity, one can easily see that g should be minimal. And actually, the graphs which don't have self-intersections and can be drawn on the sphere dominate. In such a theory, the planar processes, or planar, dominate. So we should erase, for example, that. Already we see something planar. And then the next idea of Hooft was to imagine that this is actually, this can be a surface. If the graph is very complicated, very dense, many vertices, so you can imagine that it's some propagating, that all this history can be imagined like a two-dimensional surface. Or now it looks like a propagation of a string from its initials state to final state, so the string propagates, and it creates during its motion through the space-time a wall sheet, two-dimensional surface. And all the processes to in quantum mechanics, you should sum over all the processes. Essentially, you should sum over all shapes of this wall sheet.
Sorry, I'm probably not following something. So the vertices, edges, and the faces are things that are from this graph that you calculated, that you showed on the left, right?
Yes.
But the G is the Riemann surface on which it can be embedded.
Yes, G is the genus, yes. This is Euler characteristics. And
of the Riemann surface on which this graph can go.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then, then, already I can say why this model is interesting, this matrix model. Because it's the simplest toy model, as we say, for more complicated theories, where the fields depend on X, when we should integrate over the positions of vertices. It's just, it is generating just graphs without this four-dimensional embedding. To show it, one has to know a little bit about the actually Gaussian integrals and then weak theorem, which you learned today. No, you have to expand with respect to the to lambda, to the coupling lambda, do all integrals, also represent the integrals through so-called Feynman graphs. The picture will be precisely the same as this interacting picture, because in both cases we deal with the matrices. But it will be just summing up all possible graphs.
Another question. Is there any additional conditions on the indices of this matrix, ij?
On the indices?
Yeah.
What could
I
be
mean,
a condition?
Should,
it's just running from one to n.
Symmetric or any symmetric or the two
Hermitian. I said it was Hermitian.
Oh, sorry.
Hermitian matrix. But you could also try other types like for example, real symmetric. And then you get not only orientable surface, but also orientable graphs and surfaces, but also non-orientable, like Möbius sheet, Klein bottle. But here, hermeticity imposes some orientability, which is also an interesting point here. Okay, then. Now, since all this looks like a little string theory and field theory at the same time, like this is a functional baby version of functional integral of the field theory at large n, and here we have sort of a string, then there is another. There is another interesting theory, which is a gravity. And string theory is, in some sense, a theory of two-dimensional quantum gravity, because if you have a wall sheet of a propagating string, okay, you have here this string propagating and creating the surface, you can also imagine that this surface is curved. Might be embedded in four-dimensional space, or it might be not embedded in anything, just a gravity. Like our gravity seems to be not four-dimensional gravity, seems not to be embedded into anything particular, just gravity, four-dimensional gravity in four-dimensional space. And my idea was that we could approximate this curved manifold by a triangulation. Then in gravity, you usually compute an integral like for physical quantity, for some physical quantity, for some physical operator to compute the average. You have to take the integral over matrix, dg, two-dimensional matrix. The measure is very special. You learned already general relativity. It should be diffeomorphism invariant under reparametrizations of two-dimensional space. And then you can have the action. That's the general form of the Feynman integral. Which depends on g. And this action can have terms like a cosmological term, which is just d2 psi square root of the term on g, which is the area. It could have also the Einstein term, d2 psi square root of g is a curvature, and it can have curvature square term, some derivatives, which we usually drop by some dimensionality considerations. This term actually appears to be purely topological in two dimensions. It's something like 2 pi, 2 minus 2g, precisely this number which appeared in Euler's theorem. So it depends only on the topology. Here is the topology of the disk. So the values will change according to what topology of the worksheet you choose. So you see already many little similarities between just some of the graphs and some of our geometries. And since we know how to sum our graphs, we know how to solve combinatorial problem here, we can just try to write the equality sign between this functional integral and the and just the sum over triangulations or graphs. It depends on, it's like a lattice regularization of your manifold. Triangulation. And then instead of the cosmological term lambda times area, you'll have lambda times the number of triangles. It's very natural to call the area just the number of triangles. I should say that each triangle in this model is considered to be just equilateral triangle of the area 1 by definition. So the triangulation is abstract. It's not embedded anywhere. It's just counting triangulations, which means counting the number of matrix, for example, in our world, or in this primitive two-dimensional world rather. Then plus this term should have also some analogy. It's good to have analogies now to really hope that it will work, this model, and will lead to some meaningful calculations. So what is the what is the curvature? The curvature, for example, flat space the model of the plate flat space would be played by the role of the flat space would be played by regular triangular lattice. Why? Because since the triangles are equilateral, each has 60 degrees, and this is a piece of flat space. So each vertex doesn't contribute the curvature. But if you start introducing some defects, for example, you have only 5 nearest neighbors, then you have a defect of 60 degrees. Yes, one triangle is missing. It doesn't matter that they don't look equilateral. You don't need to imagine them on the blackboard. You don't have an embedding. They're abstract triangles. So here you have positive curvature. As we know, the defect is positive. And then if you have 7, for example, this 7, then the curvature is negative. And you can even write the curvature. What is the curvature? It's the defect of the angle normalized by the area. And you essentially get at the point labeled J, you calculate Rj, the curvature, as 6 minus n 2 pi over 3 nj. N is the number of nearest neighbors. Normalized by area, which is nj over 3, I guess, because you sort of take this piece of the area, one third of each triangle. And the result is, I hope I don't do a mistake in such a formula, it's this one. Now, if you want to mimic on the graph, it went there, this integral, which is integral over curvature. R, then it is not, it should be sum over all j's over the triangulation, 6 minus mj over nj, pi times n I over 3, it's the element of the area, and I over 3, as I explained, you get precisely 2 minus 2j, of course, due to Euler's theorem. And then Euler's theorem is a version of the so-called Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which essentially gave there the integral over curvature over the manifold is completely expressed through its genus. Okay, that's to give you the ideas how this could work. And then now how to compute the number of geometries, the next step. If I start, can it do, oh no, it doesn't work at the same time. If I start doing it from the matrix model, I need another 3 lectures. But let me try to use an idea of my old work where it was done almost from nothing. Suppose we want to calculate a sum over geometries spent on a given contour, on a given with a given boundary. Given boundary means essentially okay, and it is embedded in nowhere. Just you want to sum over all geometries, which means matrix G, metric G, and since it embedded nowhere, the only invariant characteristics of the boundary could be the length. The length. Then you have also to introduce some weight, otherwise it will diverge. It's e to the minus lambda times area, which also depends on g, of course, on the metric. Metric g length also depends on g somehow, etc. So this is the cosmological term. As we know, this is the main term to add there, and the rest is topological. So we don't add topological terms, they are just constants. Now, imagine that in this integral, we want to write some closed equation on this quantity. By the way, I should call it. Let me call it W L of lambda. Of lambda. You see, lambda is so-called cosmological constant, and L is the length. And it depends on nothing else for free boundary conditions. When you integrate out everything, all the metrics, essentially as if you integrate over all shapes of this wall sheet in the string theory language, it cannot depend, it can depend only on two parameters. The length, invariant length of the boundary, which you know how it's defined usually, it's integral ds square root of g a d x psi dot a psi dot b, the standard formula in general relativity, yes? So it's the only invariant, the boundary. Then imagine you want to, in this sum, you want to write a closed equation. And you want to perturb the boundary a little bit. Maybe to insert inside the integral over matrix something like delta delta j in a particular point s of the boundary, etc. Then what could be the result of such a variation? just imagine what could it be. Only two parameters, not much of space for different interpretations. So it could change a little bit the length of the boundary so that if we subtract the original quantity to make the difference infinitesimal, so sort of computing delta g of this, what we have under integral, then what we can find inside, first of all, we could have the area changed, the length changed, which means that we just introduce some operator acting on the length, on the boundary, write it in terms of the derivative of length, dl squared plus maybe next derivatives, which acts on w, this quantity, l lambda. Just hard to think anything else. The only thing which can happen, although the coefficients a, b have to be determined, but usually they have some physical meaning. Then another thing which can happen, it could happen that in fact this variation for some matrix is such that the length, the geodesics between this point where the variation is done and some point, other point on the boundary is zero. And essentially, you have to add a term where it splits into two disks with its own fluctuating metric inside. So you did the variation, and among all possibilities in the functional integral, in the sum, you suddenly get points where this variation touches the boundary. You know, this. Imagine that everything fluctuates here, and sometimes the metric, this point along some geodesics on the surface, among all possible configurations, somehow touch these two points. Then it's this situation. And this term should be taken into account separately. So this is what it can give. And also it can happen everywhere, yes? If this is zero, it can happen at the length L1, and the rest will be the length L minus L1. The total length is fixed. Then you have here the boundary of the length L, here L minus L1, L1, L minus L1, and you have to integrate over all possibilities. So integrate from 0 to L, dl, 1, W L1 of lambda, W L minus L1 of lambda. So you wrote already a ridiculously simple equation for such high matters as quantum gravity, at least in two dimensions. And it's even, so this is the equation. One can actually show that it's a copy of equation which can be written for certain quantities, in precise the quantity in this particular matrix model. It's just a matter of language, but here the language seems to be physical, more physical. And nevertheless, it's related somehow to triangulations which can be generated by the matrix model. But look at this equation, how would you solve it? Suppose we neglect all the next terms, how would you solve this equation? It's a function of parameter L. Lambda is just a parameter which will appear later in the boundary conditions. How would you solve this equation?
Laplace transform?
Yeah, by Laplace transform, because this is a convolution, typical convolution, L1, L minus L1, from 0 to L. And of course, the Laplace transform is the best mean. Namely, we introduce another quantity, WP L. P is conjugated to lambda. And it's defined as integrals from 0 to infinity, dl1, W L, W of L of lambda e to the minus L, L P, the Laplace transform. Of course, once you apply it here, it immediately gives just a product of WP, it gives W P squared. So let's start from the left hand side first. Here you multiply by exponent e to the minus LP, then integrate, then integrate by parts also. You get a boundary term at zero, and here you integrate twice. Anyway, at the end you can easily prove that you get something like, I hope again I didn't confuse. Any coefficients. Let me, by the way, put to one the coefficients A and B. It can be easily done by rescaling L. L is, after all, it's a length. You can change the units of measure. And also you can rescale W. So at the end, A and B could be put to one with the same generality. So you have P plus P squared. W of P, okay, I don't write lambda anymore, lambda is a parameter, plus there should be W naught, which means L equals zero, plus W prime naught, which is the derivative DDL for L equals zero over P. And I think, and on the right-hand side, you have WP squared. So for the Laplace image, you have just a quadratic equation. You solve it. You do the back, the inverse Laplace transform, and you get the result. And the result can be, of course, investigated in details. And some quick consequences. Okay, cool. We'll use another blackboard. What happens? I don't know. And it's important that the result, first of all, what result do we need? First of all, we have to introduce some couplings. W naught, in fact, appears to be lambda, the cosmological constant. Its image is like the area contracted to zero. So you have this balloon with the boundary contracted to zero. And this is sort of a coupling. I could motivate more about why it's lambda. It's similar to cosmological coupling, but at least it's a function of coupling, or a coupling. Anyway, we need some particular value of this coupling. We need a critical value. Only in the critical regime, when lambda is close to some specific critical point, which can be completely established from solution, some interesting and universal, physically universal phenomena happen. In particular, if we compute, for example, the two-point, the sum over geometries for closed surface. For example, here one point is fixed. But if you fix 2 points, already it's a meaningful quantity. It can be extracted from there. It's essentially the first derivative of, it's essentially the next term of expansion, W prime for L equals zero. And then one can realize that it behaves as a constant, an interesting constant, at lambda going to lambda critical, plus square root of lambda critical minus lambda, maybe with some constant. And this, so let me call it to the power 1/2. It's the first singularity we encounter when we study it. In fact, since we know that since we know that sum over closed surfaces with e to the minus lambda area over areas, it's also a Laplace transform. We can do this Laplace transform and easily find that, for example, the number of surfaces, we fix the area now doing the Laplace transform with respect to areas, surfaces. All surfaces geometries. I would better say geometries with topology of sphere. As a function of area, suppose you solve the following problem. You fix the area of your two-dimensional universe and you sum up over all geometries. It appears to be to have a very universal form. It's A to the power minus, I guess, 7/2. Just from this result, we can induce this. And e to the lambda critical times area. So it's exponentially large, but there is also a universal pre-exponential, which we were going after, which can be calculated also by direct functional integral in formalism, so-called Polyakov formalism, in Polyakov string theory. It was verified after I realized that already in a real functional integral for Einsteinian gravity. So it's just a little window into this huge science of matrix models, random geometries, quantum gravity, non-critical strings, as they call them, now. There are many variations of this subject. For example, I have to finish. So I finished a good piece, but of course, a half of what I wanted, but it was inevitable. And I wanted to speak a bit about how these ideas evolved already into a subject which is related to the exact solution of four-dimensional Young-Mills theory at large n, n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. Maybe you heard from a couple of people about it, yes? Joe Minahan, Matthias Staudacher, did they speak about it?
I think, yeah.
Yes, so maybe I should just say that this picture of graphs, but already embedded into four dimensions, which we simplified here up to something embedded into nothing, it actually, it's much more complicated, first of all. So all these interactions, people try to study by so-called weak coupling expansion, which means essentially that you only you limit the number of interactions. Say these triple vertices, you fix the number of triple vertices, like only 2 or only 4, and you see what happens with only 4 or 2 interactions, and compute everything. Already it's very difficult to do it, but it was some progress. But now we really can solve at least one or maybe 2 examples of higher dimensional Young-Mills theories in the Largeron limit, in the one which I described. And actually, many little things which you discover on the way here in this picture appear to be true there as well. For example, in both cases, you discover integrability properties. Matrix models and its surfaces, they are tightly related to various integrable differential equations, like Kartevec-De Vries equation. You may not have heard about it, but you will hear about it, I'm sure, in a couple of next years. So some very famous integrable nonlinear partial differential equations. And then if you take really the whole theory of these partial differential integrable equations, they can be summarized in a so-called Hirota bilinear equation, which is a master equation of the whole integrability in some sense. And suddenly you discover the same equation in a completely new incarnation already in the full n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. And it appears to be the solution for the theory, at least for the spectrum. For the spectrum of its physical operators, for the so-called spectrum of anomalous dimensions. Okay. Then, if just to finish a little bit about this also very beautiful subject of two-dimensional gravity, quantum gravity, you can also embed it, in fact. Like, four-dimensional embedding is very complicated, but you can start embedding this fluctuating metric into some more primitive embeddings. For example, here essentially what I told you about was an embedding into one point, zero-dimensional embedding, yes? Because you have the integral over geometries, but these geometries, like the surfaces, are embedded in nothing. They are just manifolds with metric. So everything happens in one point in some sense, from the point of view of some exterior embedding, exterior embedding. Now, we can also... So if you look at each point of this manifold, it has no more information than just a part of the surface. But suppose you can also try to embed it into two points. Then you say that if this point, so you have two states, up and down. So you pick a point, and here you encounter that this point of the manifold is embedded into that upper point, this place, and somewhere else, maybe also this, and somewhere else down, etc. So you cover the whole manifold by these arrows up and down. Maybe you heard about Ising model. No? So you say if you are on the triangulation or on a more general graph, then you can give a nice meaning to it as an Ising model on a random graph. So you can have spins going up, down, up, up, down, etc. You just put a configuration of spins. Then you can organize the interaction between spins. The weight of interaction is sum. The Boltzmann weight is sum over nearest neighbors. Say you can call I, J, K, etc. Nearest neighbors on the graph. So it's on the graph G. And you have sigma I, sigma J, where each sigma I takes values plus minus 1. Then you, at some point you will sum over all configurations of sigmas, and you will compute the partition function. Then, in addition, you could also sum over graphs. with a fixed area, or you can weight it with cosmological term, as it is done here. And you have a model, an easing model on random graphs. For example, for fixed topology, for sphere, you can put it on the sphere. And long ago, I proposed to use matrix models in this way and solved in this way this Ising model on random graphs. And this revealed also very interesting properties. It appeared to be like in our world, you have a fluctuating metric, Einstein theory. You have a metric, then this metric can fluctuate because it's quantum. And then you can have so-called matter fields, yes? You can have scalars, fermions, quarks, etc. So here it appears to be two-dimensional. So this model, you know maybe that on the flat lattice, Ising model can be solved in terms of free Dirac fermions, yes? Massive fermions. Here it's the same. You can just show that this is a theory of two-dimensional fermions coupled to two-dimensional gravity. And you can solve the model by means of two matrix integral already. Here it was one matrix integral, but there exists a two matrix integral, which I will not write, which was also solved in this famous paper of Brizan, Parisi, Sexon. No, it was in the next paper of Sexon and Zuber, and Nechta also. And I employed it to find all the critical phenomena similar to, there is a similar ferromagnetic phase transition, the critical exponents change. It's a different class of universality, as we say, in the theory of phase transition. So it's a very amusing model, and at the same time, it's a little string theory, or at the same time, it's a gravity interacting with fermions. So there are nice openings into a big subject. Then you can put many more fields. You can consider the whole families of spin models, such as POTS models or vector models, and solve them also. It's a beautiful world, and many people spend a lot of time somewhere in the late 80s, beginning of 90s, on that models. And actually, you can solve 3 minutes more. It's okay. Just to show you that this method, which I showed, very geometrical, immediately can be generalized to this model. And I will leave it to you as a homework for those who want, how to solve using this method the Ising model. Namely, just the idea, of course, I will not even go through the solution. The idea is the following. Now, on your surface, you have spots of spins looking up. Yes? Say, let me now draw it the following here. So this is a boundary. This is the surface. Now you can have, suppose you have the boundary with all spins up, then you can have spots of spins down. Let me just color them into black. So white, that spins up everywhere, and here spins down. Then you have also inside this spot, you can have another spot. That way, here it's here are the spins down, here again up, etc., etc. So you have to color your surface into such areas of spins up and down. And let's call it W length L, again the length of the boundary. At the boundary you have spins up, so you have to precise that this is sum over all geometries and all spin configurations with spin up. It depends on coupling, we'll precise it. And then of course you have a similar object where you have spins down everywhere. That's why it's essentially black, but with white spots, etc. So just the opposite boundary condition. You have spins down. And then suppose you want to do the variation. And what can happen, the variation of the boundary in the same spirit, what can happen if you do the variation here? Of course, again, the length can change, but also, so you can have d square plus dl plus dl square, etc., acting on w. But you can also have, of course, you can have this term as usual. So this boundary can touch itself, the place where you vary some other place. So you have this splitting into two, which is just W up L1, L minus L1 integral JL1 up to L. But another phenomenon can happen. This spot can happen to be too close to the boundary. When you vary it, you pick the spot as well. Then you have to write, so this is the configuration like this. So you have a spot of the length L. Here you have spins up, but the spot has the spins down, of course. That's why it is the spot. Then you have another term here, integral from 0 to infinity over this L naught, dl naught, because the spot can have any length. W L plus L0, it's this plus that spin up times W L0 for this spot spin down. So, and the same you should write for both, for the boundary spins up and the boundary spins down. You have a coupled system of equations which you solve in the same way as the previous one. It's a fun to solve it. There is a new constant, of course, C, which appears here for the interaction between two types of W's. And this actually is related to the temperature of Isaac. I forgot to write beta. C will be something like e to the beta, the Boltzmann weight. And then it appears to be also absolutely equivalent with a good identification of parameters to the two matrix model. Maybe of the kind integral dm1, dm2, e to the trace cm1 and 2 plus m1 squared plus m1 cubed plus m2 squared plus m2 cubed. This is some coupling lambda here. So something like that with this interaction and 1 and 2. So all these methods appear to be equivalent, but this one looks nice and physical. So I at least managed to tell you half of the story, but maybe it was the only possibility. Thank you.
Question? So I'm not sure where I missed the point. So when you suppose you apply this theory to the real world, what will affect this lambda?
The real world, you mean?
Yeah.
Four dimensions.
Yeah.
Already you get stuck at the first step.
Suppose you have this lambda, the parameter.
Already the problem is that what is the boundary? Imagine in our world, the boundary. It essentially depends on three-dimensional geometry, which has a lot of parameters. It's the whole curved manifold, which has curvature, which has, you see, two dimensions, the boundary is just a line. And since you have no embedding, since you integrate over all the geometries, the boundary can be characterized only by length. It doesn't even have the curvature because you integrate it over everything inside.
What about this lambda?
Of course, it's the cosmological constant, which is usually called large lambda. It's a term introduced by Einstein. And You certainly can introduce it, but not solve the quantum model. It's just lambda times the four volume of the manifold, yes? Like universe.
So is it the lambda in this series kind of backbone?
I just didn't hear well the last word.
Is it something like a background?
Background. What do you mean background? The boundary? The background of what?
Sorry, forget it.
No, I meant simply things which you learned in a classical way, of course, in general relativity course. We just learned about geometries. The quantum gravity roughly is you just should sum up our geometries with a certain weight, which is usually Einstein action or something e to the minus Einstein action. It's the general principle of Feynman functional integral. To quantize the system, you have to, instead of minimizing the action, you sum over all possible histories, all possible configurations with the weight e to the minus action, yes? Times 1 over h bar. Yes?
All right, so maybe a short question. Is this the way you triangulated your, say, dimensional manifold, is this somehow connected to this so-called dynamical triangulation? Sorry.
Yes, yes. It has a few names, but one of them is dynamical triangulation because you see you sum over graphs of triangulations. The partition function, not log of partition function, as you do for various solid state applications related to random, for example, random defects. There you have to average the physical quantity, like free energy, log of this, or these defects. Whereas here, you sum the partition function, which means that you have a dynamical degree of freedom. Your graph here is a dynamical degree of freedom.
So if you do this Ising model on this triangulated manifold, say.
Yes.
Is there some way you kind of think about the spin up or spin down as being something connected to curvature of it?
As I said, it's like two-point embedding. So if you speak about two-dimensional curvature of manifold, then that's what I said. The triangulation is a perfect appeared to be a perfect model of fixed metric, and sum of triangulations is a quantum metric. But with 2 points, it's hard to imagine any exterior curvature, say the curvature in the embedding space. Yes, you have to be higher in dimension. You can go up to one-dimensional embedding and solve this model. So the best you can do, it's so-called C equals one model. All this can be embedded into time. But what is curious also that from these fluctuating degrees of freedom of metric, another second dimension emerges. So the effective theory for this sort of non-critical string theory shows the second dimension to emerge. They call it Liouville dimension because there is a certain Liouville equation which is found by Polyakov and actually is. So somehow there is a hidden dimension and the whole theory appears to be two-dimensional. Actually, the same happens in ADS CFT for this n equals four young Mills. It's a four-dimensional theory, but due to similar effects, due to some internal degrees of freedom of planar graphs, you see that a new dimension, this fifth dimension, emerges. It's more in a more complicated way, but essentially, first lessons were learned in the matrix models about how it could occur. Why it is good, all these matrix models, I mean, how to call it, this lower dimensional string stuff. You see many phenomena in their very simple incarnation. You really can study, for example, you not only can study what we did here, the string theory with one string. It's essentially the propagation of one string which makes you, for example, the wall sheet of a simple topology, like a sphere or a disk. But then you can even find the result for all possible interactions of strings. Of course, you saw in various popular books on string theory that, in fact, you are interested in interactions of strings. So you have not only a disk, but there could be a handle, which means that a string was emitted from this string, and then they meet together. There is a string loop, which is weighted by G string, which is here 1 over n. The string interaction coupling is 1 over n if we compare it to our topological picture, which I tried to show. And then you have more interactions, etc. So in fact, this matrix model stuff allows to solve the whole problem at all at once. You can find the universal behavior, this kind of behavior for any topology. For example, here you'll have the answer for more complicated topology of genus G is known, as far as I remember. We calculated it also somewhere in the beginning of 90s. It's 1/2 plus 5 over 2 G. That will be the result. And even this coefficient, depending on G, is universal and can be fixed for any topology. And the whole model can be described by an equation which is famous in the KdV context, which is called Penleve 1 equation, which is simply f2' plus f square equals x. So somehow the whole problem boils down near the criticality, lambda critical, where it's the only interesting place for us, because you really study very large triangulations, which can be approximately smooth. And then everything boils down to this not very trivial equation, actually, but you can study it, of course.
More questions? Don't be shy.
Yeah, I didn't give you much space for the questions. I'm sorry.
Okay, so let's thank Vladimir.